Sorry, I'm being a hog.
So today we're going to be going over a kind of like long history slash short history of public health, largely in Britain and the United States, but thinking about how these disciplines got not just developed but coined and really sort of framed out in a very specific sort of way, with a specific agenda, methodology, and even a kind of rubric, since there's a logic to what public health means. A couple weeks ago, or maybe it was a couple months ago, we talked about Journal of the Plague here again on the phone. You can see sort of the grumblings of public health there in terms of organization and the consideration of the different ways to curtail and contain a particular type of contagion, quote-unquote, a term we'll talk about in a second. Even the notion of contagion well predates modern notions of germ theory, bacteriology, etc. So that and the idea that something could be communicable, transferable, or even have a public consciousness or a public health consciousness related to it well predates the era that we're looking at today, today largely being 19th and early 20th century. Having said that, this period is significant because now we're isolating, identifying, and really determining not just that there could be an association between the transfer of illness, that there actually might be a specific logic. A logic so closely related to what we've talked about the last 2 weeks, which is to say a kind of experimental, a kind of scientific understanding of epidemiology and of the clinic. So that in public health really gets coined, really gets defined at this time. Not born, but defined and almost not finalized, but really starts to be finalized in some way. Today what we're going to do is sort of a basic breakdown. I'm going to go through a handout that I made for everybody about significant dates in the sort of first wave of public health consciousness in Britain, which pretty much takes us from the beginning of the 1800s through about the start of the 1900s. This is a period where we see major changes in poor laws and also in the concepts of epidemiology that are just about to be born. So it sounds like it's a history lesson in politics, which it is, but that's the cornerstone about how to take a municipal understanding of disease and to put it into law and put it into practice. So that's the first thing we're going to do is go through this handout. Be prepared, though, if you're going to write on this handout, save a little room on the back or something, because what I'm going to give at the end is a little forward look to what do we mean when we say germ theory and contagion in the very modern sense of understanding germ theory. Because here we're talking about putrefaction, contagion, different types of communicability that for us aren't quite what we're used to in terms of microbiology and such, bacteriology. After talking about this public health breakdown, I want to have us look at that article called Providence of Putrefaction. Then I'm going to have us turn to the case of Typhoid Mary, the article I had you read, as well as some images I brought to class. And then the last thing we're going to do is actually look at some 20th century public health posters, particular ones from the First World War, interwar period, to try to get a sense about how do modern conceptions, visual and linguistic, sort of speak to our understandings of what public health language might look like.
There you go. Anybody else see one?
Great. Let's start with this handout. If you pull out this handout then on public health, what I want to do is just walk us through some of the basic facts that we're talking about here. One thing to note is the first date that I provided for you here at the top, 1790 to 1830. Now, we know very well that speaking about the 1790s, the first thing that comes to mind to us as medical historians is Paris medicine, the decade that really changed the organization and the training of clinical practice and also the way in which clinical dissemination happened. To that, there's also a contention in this period. If one of the cornerstones of Paris medicine was the idea of training people in a clinic, but also having them have an interaction with medicine in practice, not just in theory, a cornerstone of Paris medicine then is a kind of materialism that's attached to it. To that end, the suspicion and the worry that can be attached to Parisian, French, or continental notions of medicine also is a tension for those who are English. So it says here, materialism seems to be an insulting term in England. Paris, the Paris school is perceived as materialist. I set this up for the fact that if there is a material cornerstone to the way in which Paris medicine works, then that means there's also a materialist kind of suspicion to thinking about disease and contagion. What that means then, when we talk about materialism, does everybody know what I mean? We're talking about tangibility, tactility, something you can put your hands on, so to speak. So the question of thinking about disease in a materialist way has a relation to the way in which medical training and medical organization is very materialist in the way it was done in Paris. You've got to be on the ward, you've got to be in the clinic, you've got to get your hands dirty, so to speak, to understand medicine. To that end, all of the advancements that happened in public health in the 19th century have at their cornerstone a tension with, do you or don't you buy a sort of materialist understanding of disease? Do you think contagion, disease, putrefaction is actually something tangible that needs to be contained or sort of qualified in some way? Looking at it here, the 18th century England comment I have here on the third line, charity is seen as the vehicle of social progress, is what that states. Now, what I want to mention about that is this. If Paris medicine changed the way that the clinic and the hospital became a place not just to go and receive treatment or to die or to possibly go for treatment and became the cornerstone institution for being treated, for being having procedures done on you, for being diagnosed, but also for your clinicians to actually be trained and learn that, then what it also threatened, though, was the hospital as a charitable institution. Not as a place that was the outreach of the church or a philanthropic measure, but actually an institution, a place, a space, the clinic as the cornerstone of a profession. To that end, the idea of thinking about how to ensure social progress. When we talk about public health, we're talking about disease, we're also talking about social organization. The clinic as a space of materialism and of clinical training, but that it also threatens the kind of philanthropic or charitable cornerstone of how parishes and how hospitals are organized or clinics are organized becomes a contentious spot. Now, it sounds like a lot, but what I'm just setting up for you is this. We're in a very delicate time here at the beginning of the 19th century where how the clinic is organized, the work that it is doing, and how disease and contagion is understood are all in flux. What's happening then is that public health is one of those rare disciplines in medicine that touches on all three. It touches on all three because it requires spaces. It requires a material, tangible understanding, and it's connected to a social organization inherently in its very definition. So while lots of different kinds, and one could argue all parts of medicine are getting challenged and disrupted during Paris medicine just after, public health might be the one that's challenged on all fronts, and not surprisingly, the one that actually in some ways gets developed like never before during this century, because it speaks to all of these particular branches that Paris medicine and the clinic as an institution are affording and making possible. I have a little back history for you here underneath where it says the poor, and it mentions the Elizabethan Poor Law of 1601. This is the first official poor law in England, and what it's supposed to provide is a sense of institutional, governmental, and even parliamentary approved sort of like outreach for the poor. And when we say poor, we also mean the infirmed and the ill. To that end, it's an understanding of what kind of, not just responsibility, poor always sounds like outreach, really, but you should also know that poor also means organization. Poor laws are there not just to dole out services to people, but how can we also contain and help these people in and put them in a proper place? So poor laws become significant in the 1600s, in the 1700s, in the 1800s, and now moving here at the beginning of the 1900s, and not just the kind of services we can provide people, but how can we also control, contain, move, and make sure that we're sequestering people who need particular services. Poor laws are charitable, but poor laws are, in their ways, even going back to the 1600s, an attempt to find a kind of organization. Now, this question of contagion becomes important because what we're trying to contain when we contain contagion is not just an essence of disease, but the essence of things that seem undesirable. Now, we've mentioned in the past about madness and the creation of asylums as an attempt to not just contain mad people, but mad qualities that we've not always liked in the history of medicine. Well, poor laws and notions of public health are a bit like that as well, too. How can we provide services that provide outreach, but how can we organize our various cities, our various parishes, our clinics, and even our countries to best compartmentalize people who need certain services? So this gave rise to a system of relief, is what these poor laws did. Now we're going to see a major change of this, though, as we reach the beginning of the 18th century. I listed for you a couple of people here, and I want to say these are the three most important figures to know in terms of thinking about British public health policy at this particular time in the 1800s. And they're listed on here, but I'm going to write them on the board in case you need to circle them. The first person that's going to be absolutely central to this discussion is a person named Jeremy Bentham. I'll just list them all right now, actually. So Jeremy Bentham, Thomas Malthus, Us and Edwin Chadwick. Just so you know, these two being closely aligned. Jeremy Bentham is quite famous for a lot of reasons. He's done a lot of British history. What's that?
He invented the Panopticon.
He invented the Panopticon. Does everyone know what the Panopticon is? It's a Foucault favorite.
You were talking about it.
I was a little bit.
It's the prison with the central central watchtower shaped like a spoke, and it's the idea that, you know, that everyone can be watched at all times, so they don't need to be, and you can just have one guard for like thousands of prisoners.
So instead of having a prison that's like hall after hall after hall with no reparative organizational architecture, the Panopticon would be, the prison would be this table, and the watchtower would be in the center, and radiating out of it would be the wards, and there would be a sense that they could be observed at all times. Now, on the one hand, that sounds incredibly surveillance-oriented, right? But the fact of the matter is it's supposed to provide a modicum of reform. So what cures people or what punishes people in a prison isn't just locking the door and throwing away the key. It's actually making them feel like they're being scrutinized, observed, to some degree, then accountable for their own sort of, like, reform in some way. But Bentham is actually important because of the fact that he was a general sort of reformer in general. To that degree, he was a significant figure in the 1800s for a lot of British, French, and American politicians and political theorists. He is one of the people who's considered the founding idealists of the welfare state, this idea that there is a responsibility of a national or a government to provide services towards people. He was one of the first people to propose widespread, based a lot on John Stuart Mill, notions of freedom of speech, freedom of religion, at all costs, no matter how offensive that we have. To that degree, he's considered very forward-thinking. Bentham, in fact, is one of the first people to write treatises on the fact that they needed to decriminalize laws on homosexuality. This was going back even to sort of like 1800, which is a very progressive thing. But his idea being not that he had a particular sympathy towards homosexuals, but that if you're going to grant liberties, then just open the door wide open, if you will. Bentham's basic philosophy is that he's the ultimate utilitarianist in the sense that he's for the greatest good for the greatest number of people. And to that end, what he's trying to provide, and this fuels his notion of the welfare state, this idea that we need to be mindful of not just how we take care of individual persons, but how we organize our various societies can have a tremendous effect on the messages we send to them, but also the quality of life that we provide for them. I mention this because Bentham becomes a significant person in the reform of these poor laws. That these poor laws don't just need to be about providing a couple of services to people in need or about providing a kind of organization for the less fortunate, if you will, but actually a superstructure for the organization of a nation or a city itself with which best to help all people. Poor laws of how they're infrastructurally put together benefit all persons, not just the poor persons. To that end, what he's proposing is a kind of organization of a city owing to matters of services, cleanliness, hygiene, efficiency, that makes possible the greatest good for the greatest number of people. To that end, Bentham is not necessarily the person who founds notions of 19th century public health, but it's the cornerstone of his political ideas that create the notions that make possible public health as a kind of medical discourse. To that end, you'll see here, it's mentioned underneath, that people are referred to as Benthamites when they talk about public health kind of context in 19th century Britain. Now, one of his rivals, so to speak, was this figure, Thomas Malthus, who we see here. Thomas Malthus was famous as a famous demographer, which is to say he was interested in like population statistics, that sort of thing, where to best not have overpopulation or underpopulation. But he was a political theorist as well. He was anti-poor law, his belief being that poor laws didn't actually help persons, but actually only left them to the whim of a governmental agency that didn't account for the needs of all people. To that end, Bentham and Malthus are actually not that different, and they both had a problem with early poor laws. The difference being that Bentham wanted to improve the poor laws that were in place, and that Malthus wanted to jettison them entirely. The important thing to note is that there's a growing dissatisfaction in general in the beginning of the 19th century with poor laws as they had been put into place 100 or 2 years prior. But this pressure coming from not just the inefficacy of those particular laws, but the way in what constitutes efficacy at that time had changed, given changes in how the clinic was being organized. Yeah?
Can you give some examples of what the poor laws might have been?
Prior? They might have been about, like, how to provide the greatest number of food in a certain parish for a certain number of people because they were in proximity to another set of population that had more goods. So if a poor neighborhood was close to a rich neighborhood, then we needed to help that poor neighborhood because of the proximity that they were. Not bearing in mind that there may be a similar need across town.
The government would have legislated that?
Yeah.
The community would give to that community?
Yeah. A poor law would have also been very significant at the movement, the transplantation of certain populations from one part of town to another. So it becomes almost like a gentrification of some parts of town as well. Poor laws are significant then because they're still a part of, and these poor laws from the 17th century and 16th century, because of the fact that they're outreaches of charity, of philanthropy, even though they're moving through the government. We see a comparable thing happening medically, clinically, in the 19th century, in this reimagination of the clinic as not just a philanthropic space, but also the cornerstone of a professional space for medicine. And the third figure out here is Edwin Chadwick, and this is probably our most important person. A lot of this has been backstory, but it's Chadwick that we're really leading to. Chadwick was the person who was the secretary to Jerry Mamie Bentham for a while. He was, his dates, by the way, if you want to know, were 1800 to 1890, which is to say that he was working largely just after Paris Medicine had largely been in place in Europe and had migrated somewhat to England, starting by the 1830s. But what he's doing is trying to think about new poor laws that can be put in place in England as an attempt to reorganize the kind of services that are given to the poor. And again, when we say poor, we're quite often talking about disease. This is why it's so central to the notion of public health. And the way that these new laws can actually be a part of this new form of medical, clinical sort of understanding. The central tenet then is, yeah, Vic.
The hygiene issues in the poor law, does this reflect the fact that poor laws initially were defective, or was it a result of the change in the society to a more urban industrial society?
Well, I'd say it's a bit of both. So the effectiveness might be in the sense that the initial poor laws were very good at giving out services, but didn't have a significant effect on containing diseases. That's why when we even look at something like, you know, the Journal of the Plague here and see when the plague happens, we see that the best thing that helps the plague is just that it sort of runs its course after a year or two. Now, the services and the support that we can give to the people are there, sometimes help. The other thing that changes, too, is just what's the definition of efficacy also, too, at this particular time. So it's a little bit of both. This new poor law of 1834 had basically three basic tenets to it that I have here. One is that it says the real problem, and the real problem being of poverty and also of disease, is a residual mass of people who don't work. Now, that is to suggest that not just this idea that people who are not contributing, not productive, or in some way prone to disease, but also the fact that idleness can lead to festering, if you will, to some degree. So poor laws need to be mindful of not just giving out services, but how to remedy the fact that we can have an environment that sets up the possibility for putrefaction, if you will. There's a distinction one might make at this time, a tension about trying to figure out pre-germ theory, pre-bacteriology, how do we understand infection, or how do we understand contagion at this particular time. I would say there's two kinds of distinctions that are at place here. One of them is mentioned in one of the articles I had you read. Is disease, is infection proximate or is it remote? To that degree, does an illness, does an infestation, does a contagion happen in a certain part of a city because of the fact that it is, because it is proximate, close to this place, or because it is remote, has come from afar and infiltrated that space as well? Has the poverty of people in a certain part of town given rise to this illness? Or has the poverty in that particular part of town made it vulnerable to an illness that has come in? This is one tension that's in place. The second is the sense of a residual versus an imposed form of contagion, if you will. This is a similar sort of problem, but it's this question again about whether the individuals themselves and their very diet, lifestyle, character, morality have in some way made possible this illness, or if in some way the illness is in some way infused or made possible those character flaws, if you will. To that end, we're going to find, even moving up until the 20th century, this question of public health as a kind of physical hygiene and this question of public health as a kind of moral hygiene are almost always intertwined, almost all the way until the present day, as we're going to find. The important thing to note is that in trying to organize how charity, how churches, how clinics and hospitals, which have their own religious and charitable institution, structure to them, we can see that public health from its foundation is invested in qualities that don't just deal with whether someone's sick or not, but they also deal with whether someone is poor or not, whether someone is clean or not, and whether somebody is morally and ethically clean or not. They're all sort of infused and imposed and in some way expected of why public health was generated and what public health was expected to do, particularly in the 19th century. The two other categories I have here for you after the residual question, the second is A breakdown of the terrace system and the creation of workhouses is a definitive 19th century creation. Now, it says here, to make the conditions in workhouses worse than anywhere else outside, you might want to put a little clause on the side that says, but still better than before, which is to say, there's an attempt on the part of Chadwick in organizing this notion of workhouses. One, to make sure that we can take whatever sort of like suspicious or sometimes less than standard conditions for work or cleanliness or living and put them in an institutional space. We're actually going to prove what's outside of that institutional space. This is what motivates the creation of workhouses, which is a little bit different, if you remember, than what Foucault said in terms of the creation of the asylum. Foucault's belief was that we were doing a great confinement here. The point of it was simply to contain. Well, the truth is that Chadwick, in particular the creation of workhouses, the point is to provide productivity to these people, to put them to work, as Foucault said. Part of the point is to contain it, but the major portion is actually to improve those conditions outside. So the workhouse becomes significant not just in terms of what it keeps inside its walls, but actually how it improves the condition outside the walls. This is a point that Foucault doesn't actually talk about as much. To that end, it's actually that's what public health's cornerstone is. Maybe we actually need to create spaces where we can put people to work or where we can have conditions that may not be ideal and desirable, but actually we can improve the conditions more globally or in a different way across the board for people living outside of these institutions. And lastly, the Benthamite solution, as Chadwick put forward, is always seen as a scientific solution to a social problem. Now, that question of it being called a scientific solution is just to make the distinction that it's not merely a philanthropic solution or not merely an economic solution, but actually that there is a kind of clinical solution. And it is the transformation of the clinic as a space of clinical training and clinical treatment after the aftercare of medicine that really makes possible the idea of poor laws, the idea of workhouses, the idea of Benthamite attitudes towards health to be really seen as scientific. And that's a major change. In fact, I think it's the linchpin that makes possible all different kinds of sequesterings and organizations, different societies, the all kind of jettisoning of certain populations that have happened before for many, many centuries for persons who have been potentially contagious. What changes in the 19th century is some of those very same practices that are put into place are now seen as scientific, or a scientific sort of agenda to them. Any questions before we turn to the next page? Okay, another page. And now, the new poor law does not work. The first thing to note here. Now, why that's significant is because what we're talking about here, again, is the fact that we're talking about a question of contagion, putrefaction, even sort of like infection that predates notions of bacteriology and even viral theory. And to that end, what we're seeing is some ways that aren't seen efficacious in terms of how these organizations are happening. But it's the motivations behind them that are scientific and that are trying to restructure and integrate science into a way that this kind of cultural and social services are provided. Now, what happens, of course, here is the houses fill up. The attempt to provide these kinds of workhouses, these particular organizational spaces that themselves can contain all of the potentially people who need work or the people who are infectious or poor or diseased, actually creates not a solution for what's outside the walls of those poor houses, but actually an overfill up, if you will, in those particular spaces. Yeah.
People live there as well as work there.
They do.
Just like a ghetto.
Yep. So they either live inside the space or live in close proximity to it, but it is this idea of trying to ghettoize, if you will, particularly. But even that is an attempt to organize and structure not just a clinic, but actually an entire town or entire municipality to some degree. To that end, Paris medicine became so significant in wanting to organize the clinic. The point about public health changes in the 19th century was that we can actually organize our towns and our parishes and our cities the same way, and sometimes for the very same purposes, not just to provide organization, but actually to improve efficacy and to cut down on contagion and disease rate. So the big things that are happening now in the 1830s that are an attempt to organize and change beyond just workhouses are these: an attention to the water supply, an attention to sewage removal, and a focus on diseases in particular or conditions that have been described for persons and that certain ones might be more prone to a kind of need of curtailing or organization. Now again, all of this is in the service of not having developed microbiology and bacteriology to the degree with which we can isolate the exact causes microbially or anatomically that are causing these conditions. We're already isolating at this time that when we seem to focus on the water supply or the sewage, or as we see in the article on putrefaction, diseased and rotting bodies, or here thinking about certain diseases more than others, the ones that we know are particularly contagious bacterially, then we notice that there's already an attempt to refine a system of poorhouse laws, of workhouses and of also philanthropy in a way that's learning from the experience. Medicine remains a private practice as part of the problem here. So while the clinic becomes organized as a place of training, in England in particular, medicine is largely a private practice. But this brings us to post-1830, the major changes that are happening. I started with the fact that there is a resistance to materialism in Britain leading up to about 1830, because 1830 is sort of the benchmark date that we use. Well after Paris medicine, but by about the time of major resistance to Paris medicine attachments, owing largely, to be honest with you, to French Revolution paranoia, more than actually to clinical predispositions, starts to wane. And we're starting to see by the 1830s in England, and already what's happening throughout the continent, a change towards the implementation of Paris medicine practices, but actually revision and improvement of them as well. It's really the 1830s where we start to think of as public health sort of coming to its own as a discipline. So to that end, Chadwick has contempt for the idea of individual healing of medicine. Chadwick is a devotee of Bentham, a utilitarian, and a believer that we can help an individual person by helping all persons. That public health becomes not just the vehicle towards helping large masses of people, but it becomes the vehicle towards helping individuals in particular. To that end, the question of having a public health structure, both in place in the clinic and in government, and in the everyday lives of a person, actually has the greatest efficacy. And a lot of this based on not just evidence that's happened empirically from experience, but also from the political spirit of the age, if you will. If we can help most people, then we can help the individuals as well. Now, statistics are used here in a major significant way. We talked last week a lot about Claude Bernard and different physiologists and physicians trying to take the experimental method and scientific practice and statistics in particular as a way to make medicine not just better, but to make medicine scientific more explicitly. Public health becomes a major vehicle for that. So that if it becomes significant by the 1830s in Paris, for example, to not just learn in a hospital and implement Paris medicine, but actually to start doing more experimentation and to start doing experiments as part of your clinical training. Because without it, it really isn't medicine because it isn't really science. Public health, as it's bubbling up at this time, in its reliance on demography, and its reliance on statistics, and its reliance on numbers and facts, and even a kind of experimental method, trial, error, hypothesis, conclusion, is lending itself very well towards the experimental and scientific method. What is making it ripe then, not just for improvements, but as an ideal medical science of its day and age. It's as though there is a whole constellation of ideal factors which constitutes the most admirable current form of medicine by the 1830s and 40s, that it's as though public health has been waiting for that very environment to make it possible. So that if you need to be concerned with the greatest welfare, public health is there. If you need to be concerned with the organization of a society, public health is there. If you need to have the clinic as a cornerstone of that dissemination, not as a form of philanthropy, but as a form of science, public health is there. If you need the experimentation to make science and medicine respectable and better, public health is there. And lastly, if you need to use statistics and numbers to prove that you're efficacious at all, public health means shit without numbers. It's there. So public health becomes so significant at this time, not because there weren't grumblings of it before, but it's as though the very template for what makes science and medicine at this time perfect for public health to take off. So that's sort of the groundwork that we have here. I want to point you to a couple of theories and facts that are on this page before we start moving to the articles. First thing to note is this article I wanted you to just pick and make note of as a kind of like canonical text. And this is the report on the sanitary condition of the laboring population by Chadwick from 1842. This is one of those cornerstone texts. And I say cornerstone because it forms a foundation, but it actually also turns the corner, if you will, for when public health becomes a potential solution innovative to concerns of philanthropy and poor poverty and health, to being actually the significant factor. So this report on sanitary conditions being significant, it provides us then this cornerstone idea then of contagion. Contagion, as it's defined at this time, I've written here, is the transfer of a disease from one person to another by some known or unknown agent or means. Now that's a very loosey-goosey definition, but it's probably the best one that there is at that time, and yet even that definition is a major significant change. We had talked a lot about the last several months in particular, that moving away from classical notions of medicine, its basis on humoral theories of medicine, into a more sort of like global sort of like concern about health as a general concept, meant that we were shifting away from disease as being a person case specific sort of understanding. The humoral theory, going back to Galen and Hippocrates, meant you could have a set of symptoms and you could have the identical set of symptoms, but these could be two very different things going on. changes in how medicine was supposed to be unified and democratized in particular, as we look to Paris medicine, is about saying, well, what's uniform about these cases? How could these two people might actually have something similar? And the difference being then is that next thought leads to they might have the same thing. Whereas prior to about the 18th century, I would have looked at these two people and said, their bodies both have similar things that are wrong with them. We're starting to see by the 18th and 19th centuries that they might actually have something that might be wrong with them. So contagion then becomes this idea, not that there's something wrong with you and that it might affect someone else, disrupt the balance in someone else, but there might actually be something in you, affecting you, in some ways, been transferred to you that could potentially be transferred to another. This provides a different way of thinking about organizations of poor law and contagion that changes. So contagion is invented at this time, but how you define contagion has changed. It's a difference that we're going to talk about in a second, but I just want to throw these terms up. Because at this time we're talking about several terms that have some overlap. Infection, contagion, putrefaction, and then ultimately to what we get to is notions of bacteria, germ, that sort of thing. We're going to be more precise and specific in how we define those agents, if you will. To that end, contagion is understood both as being a person-to-person sort of factor, as it's listed here, and also being as environmental. And this is the tension. What is contagion? What is putrefaction? Is it something that is made possible because it is residual to some place, some category, some constellation of factors? Or is it because it's something that's imposed, that literally comes in on its own as a particular agent? A kind of, I'll give you an example. Example here. A kind of debate at the time would be, there's a neighborhood of people living in West Philly on the blocks of 44th to 45th Street, but we know that there's a lot of sewage there, we know that there's a lot of poverty there, we know that prostitution tends to take place there, we know that the people have late night hours at that particular time, and we also know that their diet might be less. Well, do we think that there is something that has been made possible because of a poorness in diet, a lack of hygiene, and a lifestyle choice that's not appropriate that has given rise to the number of deaths that are happening there? Or could it be that there was some unknown agent that normally would not affect a different part of town, but because of the poor standards of health, morality, and hygiene in that space, made them vulnerable to that agent that came in? It's not wildly different than a lot of other kinds of epidemiological discourses we have now. But that tension between was it something approximate or remote, residual or imposed, provides the crux for how we have not finalized or resolved what the best way to implement some of these public health standards. And yet, it is known that these are the very kinds of questions that are the cornerstone for how to address epidemiological matters. It says here, the early 19th century provides a movement away from contagious models of disease. Laissez-faire attitudes frown upon quarantine and other restriction measures. Now, why that's significant is because what we have then is, by the second half of the 19th century, a significant shift. So if the early 19th century is an attempt to try to galvanize public health sentiments, it's in the face of an idea of thinking of contagion as maybe not the ideal solution. And yet, it's the beginning of that particular discourse. What it's going to make possible is what I'm going to lay out for you, which is why the 19th century is a significant turn. A resistance to materialism up until 1830, in England in particular, provides a resistance to contagion theory. The opening of those doors after 1830, because of the less of a paranoia about Paris medicine, starts the conversation going. And it's innovations that happened after 1850 that are going to break wide open this possibility of public health medicine. We could say then that 1790, 1830, and 1850 are three good benchmark dates to think about when public health has significant changes at this particular time. 1790, because we know it's the debate we need to be having. The 1830s, because we've gotten past our resistance to materialism as a cornerstone principle. And the 1850s, because it's undeniable that public health has an inherent basis in how the efficacy of clinical practice is done in general. If you turn the page, I'm just going to run through a few facts, and then I'm going to talk a bit about germ theory. Top of the page, this is just a basic rundown that during all of these periods, though, we're seeing all of these things being put into practice. First of all, there's a need to clean up the shit, literally, in towns as a means of preventing further disease. Now, this is done both just to improve quality of life in cities, but because it's seen now that this is an undeniable cornerstone to the efficacy of how clinics are laid out and how parishes are put together. Public health is defined by a community that is not necessarily medical, but possibly can be. Disease is local, or could be local and environmental, as the changes happening in these periods. And while there is no consensus in the medical profession, there is still a war over materialism, evolution, and debates about what constitutes the right way in which disease spreads. It's a period of flux, but it's a period in which we're seeing the debates about causality here of disease are still registered, and everyone's talking in a cornerstone about what is the communal welfare, what is the public health welfare, and what is the welfare of individuals in terms of a population. Now, what I want to turn to, though, is a brief question then about what happens after 1850, and these major questions in germ theory. And what I want to set up for you are basically what I think of as the four major decades of this era and the four major individuals. Does anybody have a question before I start writing this out?
Okay.
So, let's start with the 1850s. And our first major figure is John Snow. Everybody's familiar with John Snow. He's considered the father of epidemiology, or at least the father of British epidemiology. What his major significant contribution was that cholera outbreaks had been a regular part of British and London life for about 150 years, leading to about the 1850s. But it was Snow who first identified at that time what was the source of the cholera outbreak in 1854, I think it was. And what he was able to do was isolate a particular neighborhood and a particular agent that he thought was responsible for this disease. To that end, what he was doing was isolating not just the contributing factors and the kinds of people who could be susceptible to this illness, but actually what its root cause could be. In particular, his focus on sewage as a particular source of that form of transmission. And it was the efficacy with which he attacked the spread of that disease, which led to him actually becoming an undeniable sort of figure from the epidemiology, was appreciated at this particular time. The three other figures might be more familiar to you in name. In the 1860s, we have Louis Pasteur. Is that right, or is it U-E-R?
U-E-R?
I got it. Great. Okay. So Pasteur, of course, being the father of bacteriology, and in particular for the work that he did in terms of fermentation and thinking about a way in which he could identify and culture, really, particular, as they would be called, agents, if you will, that could be of spread or contagion or infection. So Pasteur's work becomes significant for isolating and identifying what has already, in theory, sort of been in place. By the 1870s, we have Joseph Lister, who is significant because what he's doing is putting into place germ theory, as Snow and Pasteur, as understand it, but put it into effect in terms of surgical practice. Now, Lister is important then because of his ideas of antiseptic, and Listerine today is sort of a remnant of that idea. But the notion being that if Snow is isolating a particular disease and at a particular outbreak and a particular vehicle for it, sewage in particular, then Pasteur is taking that and being able to culture and ferment and identify and create, therefore, this very kind of contagion, this very kind of agent that has been supposed about before. And Lister is being able to curtail the creation and spread of those particular agents, those particular cultures in the surgery that's happening at that time by his sanitary standards that are happening in surgical practice. So three different figures, three different times, but all each one step upon another, adding to what had already been in place, ideas and theories related towards public health and the spread of contagion, but putting them into practice in such a way that after the 1850s, it is absolutely undeniable and irrefutable to a lot of scientists. The last person we have here is the 1890s. Robert Koch. And what he's providing for us here, then, is a question of bacterium that is even more precise, owing largely to his notion of bacteriology and its fusion with microbiology. Not that microbiology is new by the 1890s, but the way in which we're now isolating and actually identifying and seeing, therefore, these particular diseases. In his case, anthrax was the condition that he was particularly known for isolating and identifying. So we have in these different figures four different moments, and it's the people that aren't as important, to be honest with you. The great men of science in these moments, to me, aren't as significant as the movements they signify. The ability to see a culprit, the ability to then recreate a culprit, the ability to contain a culprit, and the ability to then identify and actually witness a culprit. And by culprit, I mean agent, a bacterium, or some kind of contagion that could be identified. To that end, what we're talking about here is a form of almost in practice, from one scientist to the next experimental method, to be able to have a hypothesis, to be able to test the hypothesis, to be able to put that hypothesis into practice in order to curtail how medicine is performed, and ultimately then to isolate, name, and see that particular agent of sorts, if you will. To that end, public health, epidemiology, and this question of contagion becomes the perfect articulation of what Paris medicine and its fusion with the experimental method would have wanted to happen. And it's just almost too perfect a narrative that at the 1790s, leading into about 1800, is the birth of this new change in how medicine is organized. By the end of the century, we're seeing almost perfectly bookended a story of public health that is the story of medicine and the clinic at that particular time. Any questions? Yes?
So kind of underlying all of this, I wonder if it's been mentioned or talked about sort of the history of the association of disease with like people being undesirable or with social causes, right?
Yeah.
So like I think before germ theory, the major theory was like miasma, right? Like bad air polluting people.
Mm-hmm.
But then they associated that with also like excrement, but also poor people and like undesirables basically. So I'm wondering around this time period, what happens to that theory of social determinants of disease?
It doesn't disappear. In fact, that conflation of those two qualities remains and persists. It's why we have a figure like Typhoid Mary by the beginning of the 20th century. It's why we have patient zero when AIDS comes out in the 1980s. There's this question then that while we can, after 1850, now irrefutably identify an agent or a cause, it still does not dispel the cultural predispositions that are attached to that disease.
So do people use the germ theory to further say, well, now we know the mechanism, but the agent is... are these people who are like socially undesirable, and then they're the ones who are spreading the disease?
It's interesting. Science, in many permutations, has always wanted to say that if you could isolate an absolute scientific, somatic, biological feature, you could in some way erase, vacuum out any kind of culpability that's attached to a particular virus, disease, illness, what have you. And as much as that has been an ideal sort of solution, it's never been the case, because what happens is it doesn't erase this particular problem then. Mm-hmm. Is the illness still remain as a kind of proximate or remote identity. Even in the space of germ theory and bacteriology, there still is a sense of thinking about the germ or the illness as itself being, if not the culprit of a disease, maybe it's just the manifestation of the diseasedness of the person themselves. To that end, it's not that that kind of moral critique disappears from bacteriology or epidemiology, it just changes. And what just changes is the kind of evidence that is or isn't used to purport those ideas. This is why I mentioned that long history of poor laws and undesirables and the way in which you can't escape charity. When we say charity, we mean uncharity as well, charitable and uncharitable attitudes for public health. It was born from it, and I think it will always be connected to it. If for no other reason, but when we're thinking about the common good and the welfare of so many, that is already endowed in the very notion of good with a sense of valuation. We want to think it just means healthy or not, but define even that, healthy or not, you know? So it's a kind of check that's in place decade after decade, generation after generation, century after century. Yeah?
But wasn't there some foundation for that, like the sanitarium movement? Clearly, over the natural history of tuberculosis, then there was no therapy. And that actually, while not being the ultimate answer, clearly did improve the general health at that time.
Absolutely. In fact, that's part of the reason that concerns about what's called moral hygiene become significant is because they are in many ways just as responsible and sometimes in a good way for the overall well-being and the health of a particular community. It's why we're going to look in a second, we're going to be looking at a bunch of public health posters from about the teens to the 30s from American military services that were from the mental hygiene services. And their portraits are absolutely about curtailing VD and gonorrhea and syphilis and stuff.
I saw those movies.
Yeah, but they're all contained. Totally, but they're all still imbued with those same valuations. And I don't think that's a fault of those institutions. I think it's just almost in the character and the nature with which we understand public health and health in general is in some way intertwined or embedded with common good in a larger way. Yeah.
I was going to ask how how tuberculosis fits into this whole model of like diseases and sort of like whether like they're proximate or like remote to populations, because I feel like tuberculosis at the time was like a desirable physical trait, within sort of within the upper classes to an extent, and also it was like giving like validity to poets and whatever. Like, but then again, like they were still being removed from society under doctor's orders, and I wonder if part of that had to do almost with like the same sort of poor laws and get them in the workhouse and get them like away.
Yeah.
Or because I know like a lot, well, they were just like, you know, left in their beds and in their homes, and I'm not really sure, like, mm-hmm. at the time, if there was a disparity or if it was just not considered quite as, like, undesirable a disease and why that was.
TB is an interesting case, although it's not a unique kind of case in the sense that it could stand for both one feature and its opposite. So TB could be the manifestation of the fact that there was ill repute or a bad quality of life, and one need to steer clear of it and therefore disavow it to some degree because of the fact that it was such ill repute. On the other hand, it could be the thing that was the most romantic or sort of sentiments mm-hmm. that suggested an overflowing of a particular kind of responsibility.
I feel like that was
a
disease that everybody wanted, right? Like all of the women wanted to like appear like delicate, like you know.
They would have been romantic to have died of it, you know, and maybe even in the narrative sort of context, you know, whether one willed it or not. But it was something that could be romanticized, might be the best way to put it. But it could still be vilified at the same time. Think about when we talked about the English malady. We talked about it as a construct that showed one's own gentility, and to show a kind of fragility and frailty was to, in some way, compliment oneself. And to that degree, infirmity doesn't always become a sign of one's moral depravity. On the other hand, it's the fact that frailty can actually be confirmation of the fact that one's over-endowed with a kind of different sentiment. So tuberculosis becomes significant because of the fact that it becomes this condition that suggests an overabundance of passion, an overabundance of some kind of vitality in one's life, to the point that it causes a kind of corporeal frailty, if you will. And this actually goes back a long way, since one of the early symptoms of tuberculosis is sort of coughing of blood or different conditions that really speak to a long-standing belief that there's an overabundance of one particular kind of emotion.
The humors and whatnot. But I was wondering, like, at what point, because now if you were to look at tuberculosis, it very much follows the model of all of these diseases that were happening in the 1800s, and you would go, oh, this is happening in the poor population, the overcrowded urban population. This is a disease that affects those who have like maybe who have like, you know, like, you know, more so. This is a disease of lower classes and whatnot, and this is like a problem. And as opposed to it, like, I wonder, like, when the shift happened, because it obviously wasn't happening at the time that public health reform was.
Well, let me say, a lot of this has to do also with what we think of as the distinction between rich and poor. There was, of course, a distinction then between who had a lot of money and who didn't, who was literate and who wasn't, who had clean clothes and who didn't. But what constituted the proximity between somebody who had a lifestyle of what we would consider substandard hygienically, substandard sanitation-wise, substandard dietary-wise, what have you, was not a far cry from what the highest of the high and the lowest of low would have had. So if we're just now discussing in the 1830s and 40s and 50s the idea of maybe we need to clean up the shit in our city, maybe we need to have sanitation, it suggests then that the possibility that one could be in very close physical proximity to something like tuberculosis or cholera could be very likely for somebody of the highest upper classes and the lowest of classes at the same time. Our predisposition now to want to suggest that tuberculosis or cholera is something very much of the poor classes, because we either have or have comforted ourselves with the knowledge that those scenarios, those lifestyles, those economic situations that make possible the breeding of those diseases are very far removed from what we have as first world or civilized or hygienic sort of nations. So the shift has less to do with the birth of public health, but I think it has to do with changes in hygiene, and therefore, by extension, how proximate or not proximate we feel to places that could be seen as unhygienic. Yeah, Dick.
I would disagree with the characterization of tuberculosis other than being in the minds of Victor Hugo.
Okay.
Who are the non-clinicians? I mean, in the 1870s, they actually built the sanitariums up in the Poconos. They'd take the people out of Philadelphia, send them up there. That was actually treatment. People got cured. And there was a question at that time whether it was because the fresh air cured them or they were moved from the bad environment, mm-hmm. or was it because they actually were taken to an environment where they were able to heal.
Well, they were forcibly taking people out of like poor work conditions because they were coughing up blood as factory workers, and they were rehabilitating them and giving them like new professions that they can work under their like delicate state. But not so in Europe, when you've got like, you know, even like magic mountain.
But I mean, it was also stigmatized too at the same time. I mean, in the 1920s and 1930s, the government still ran fresh air classes, they call them, where they were children from poor families and put them in basically an open air classroom, feed them supplemental food, And, I mean, I remember my grandfather threw a hissy fit when my mother ended up in one because he had a job that he was not for. And it really was a stigma to be in those classes.
I think you're both actually, and I think Dick, you hit the nail on the head when you used the word stigmatized, because it is the fact that these pieces could be stigmatized at that time. And I think the word for you is romanticized. It's not that people wanted to get tuberculosis, it's the fact that one could get it and romanticize it.
Right.
Spin it into a kind of
well,
a positive
mean, I just mean like these like silly girls.
Of
like,
course.
Like, silly high school girls want to get pregnant today.
Sure. What do you mean silly? No, right.
They're like, oh my god, if I'm had tuberculosis, all the guys would want me.
But I think the thing to note is that narratively, and I study narratives of illness, is that most of the cases one could vilify, stigmatize, or romanticize a particular illness.
Right.
But where do we see the shifts in how ubiquitous one or the other is?
The enduring narratives are the ones where it's romanticized, and I find that so interesting because the enduring narratives of what color and things are, I think, they're more stigmatized.
Not always. So, for example, if one reads Death in Venice by Thomas Mann, that person had, you know, Asiatic cholera, as it was called at that time, so to speak. It all depends on the context.
In the Magic Mountain, doesn't he, like, romanticize tuberculosis?
So all of these diseases are flexible in terms of whether they're romanticized or not.
I'll get off tuberculosis.
No, it's fine. But a big shift then happens about the context when that, once that happens. The cultural context, but I would argue also the public health context as well. How proximate or not are individuals? How comfortable or not? How safe or not people to their particular tuberculosis or cholera as an actual legitimate fatal possibility from day-to-day living life. And that changes a lot, I think, in terms of... And that is not to say also, too, that there are plenty of outbreaks of cholera and tuberculosis where we're seeing fatalities regularly where in an attempt to rescue the awfulness of the disease, there's an attempt to want to romanticize it. But that tension that you're both talking about here is you're both right. And that is the tension that is at the cornerstone of these particular conditions and at the cornerstone of really trying to address the question of what these are asking. What these are asking and what public health is asking is where does culpability lie? Is it with the conditions? Is it with the people? Is it with their actions? Is it with a germ or a bacteria? Is it with the shit that's in the street? Is it with the people living too close together? Or is it they're living too far apart? Or is it the fact that it's culpable or not because it's romantic or because it's vilified in some way? That's the big debate that's happening around public health here. And that's why I think that question about when do social characterizations attached to public health standards and services that are disseminated disappear, they never do. Because it's born in them, as we see from those public health laws and poor health laws that are there, and it's imbued in this very question of how we valorize or how we vilify illness in general. And when we take it to the stakes of not just one person, but the good, the greater good of everybody, it only almost exaggerates what I think is already inherent in those standards. Yeah, Chuck?
Don't you think that it's sort of the same as thermal AIDS?
Oh, yeah.
It's like exactly the same.
It's identical.
Like proximate versus like, oh, it's not us, it's not these certain people that can get it, it's those people. And then suddenly it was, I don't think it was romanticized, but like Magic Johnson, and then it was like, oh, wait.
Yeah.
Family Guy.
Yeah, AIDS is our latest example of the fact that it seems to be a unique scenario in terms of how we attach moral character or judgment or not for a particular condition when the fact that it's just the latest manifestation. AIDS faced the largest similarities towards discourses that we've seen on syphilis and venereal disease in the first part of the 20th century, in particular in the way that it isolates specific populations of sexual deviants and sex workers and that sort of thing, but also in the way that it reinforces, even despite the fact that we have hard epidemiological bacteriology or virology sort of evidence, still cultural preconceptions that are just, I think, a part of that discourse. And it's not a fault, I think, of either particular camp, it's just that it's inherent in those particular discussions. And it's our acknowledgement of it and our willingness to address those particular inflections, I think, that is the moral sort of responsibility in these debates. Pull up this article if you could. It's the Providence and Putrefaction text, which, by the way, is a kind of seminal text in talking about the history of public health. Christopher Hamlin is sort of like in the last 25 or 30 years, sort of like the go-to guy in terms of what we're talking about public health being born in the 19th century in Britain and France. The distinction he basically makes in Providence and Putrefaction is actually one between what might be a good way to put what public health comes out of. And that is the distinction between individual medicine versus what's sometimes called population medicine. These are very 19th century terms, but they're good ones for thinking about what's part of the stake here. If our eyes need to be on the prize as experimental scientific medical men at this particular time, are they supposed to be on the prize like this or at the prize like this in terms of its wider sort of significance? I want to just direct you to about four passages in here. I think I've done a good job of laying out the sort of chronology of this era, but I want to just give you a couple of bits of prose in here to look at more closely. Turn to page 384. This is where Hamlin provides a good definition of this one for us. Faction. This article in particular being concerned with that kind of contagion susceptibility. Future faction was a step in that dissolution, hence a prerequisite for long-term agricultural productivity. Future faction, therefore, being a sense of decomposition, a kind of rotting, a form of debasement, if you will. And that putrefaction is significant, and it's the point of this particular article, is because it can have an absolute material, tangible, physical sort of meaning, but it can also be loaded with a cultural sort of sense. If you look at the top of the page 384 and throughout the article, there's a lot of reference to zymotic pathology. I don't know if you guys have heard that term before. But this is sort of the discipline as it was defined in the 19th century and to some degree in the 20th century. But zymotic pathology basically refers to that which is infectious. Fermenting is another word that's often used, owing a lot to Pasteur, as I've read. And lastly, to, in general, a sense of the rot, if you will. So those who are attached to zymotic pathology as a specialty at this particular time, it's a code word for people who are interested in public health, but it's also a code word for people who are interested in the application of their particular brand of medical science insofar as it affected the question of whether a particular culture was rotten or not, in a very literal sense, in terms of shit and bodies and stuff on the street, but also in how it could improve the character of that particular town as well. Last week, if you were here, if you listened to the lecture afterwards, we talked about phrenology quite a bit, and the big sort of like push for that discipline in the 19th century and why it was so significant is that both in Britain and the United States and on the continent, this is referred to as the century of reform, when we're seeing the birth of racial rights and women's rights and of human rights, and coming after the French Revolution and the American Revolutions at the end of the 1700s, a really kind of a sense of democratization and democracy and sort of liberty in a major significant way. The 1800s are supposed to be this century where we're really working out in all of our different professions our duty and testament to the greater good ethically, politically, and morally towards persons. So public health, no shit, it came about in the 19th century. Of course it would. This is the century that makes it happen. So whereas phrenologists felt they were significant, as we talked about last class, because they could map the mind and think about neurology for the first time, but insofar as they could help cure social ills, this is what public health or zymotic pathology is like. It too is trying to take a branch of science, branch of medicine, improve the hygiene, the standards, the health of populations, but in an attempt to also improve the social well-being of people in general, too. So this isn't just about curbing morbidity and mortality rates by improving public health. It's also improving happiness, justice, fairness, equality in society. Public health has that kind of ennoblized sort of like investment in it. Turn to page 386. This is where we see another definition of zymotic disease. It says, the last part of this section one, in any case, the essence of the concept of zymotic disease was that disease was a spreading internal rot, that it came from an external rot, and that it could be transferred to others. We can see already here that notion of zymotic is almost trying to catch both of these things, internal and external, something that can be proximate and something that can be remote, with the idea being that it's the transfer that's the important part. So those could be from either camp and still be a part of this particular discipline of zymotic pathology. Thus, while we're trying to sort out what is the actual culprit from within or from outside for this transferable agent, it's that we agree on the transferable fact that seems to be the cornerstone of this discipline. And that's why all of this sort of like tension that's happening, this debate from two different camps about where the root causes of a contagious disease might be inherent and spread for many decades during the century. What's underlying that is a sense that there is an undeniable transferability that's happening to disease. And that's what makes possible public health, even in the face of disputes and disagreements between particular camps. it also makes possible that these great scientific advancements, using the experimental method, that are now, as a result of someone like Claude Bernard, undeniably a part of medicine, irrefutable how public health moves towards a particular notion of germ theory in particular. So in other words, whatever sort of work that was happening here in the second half of the 19th century, that kind of evidence would not have been possible and would not have been persuasive to somebody working in medicine before this particular time. Public health, therefore, finds not just its genesis at this time, but finds, more importantly, the groundwork that makes it convincing to a certain degree. And germ theory becomes sort of the last part that really enforces that. I'm going to direct just a couple passages in here because I'm kind of anxious for us to look at some pictures. If you look on 391 to 392. We'll do it on time. Okay. I just wanted to point out to here, this is the bottom of 391 where it starts, efforts to reconcile the zymotic process with divine providence. If you take that paragraph and the next two, this is where there's kind of a basic 1-2-3 breakdown of what these cornerstone features are, how we're supposed to curtail putrefaction and yet be mindful of the providence responsibility that public health is supposed to have, and as they're laid out here by Hamlin. So if you haven't got a chance to read the article, get a look closely, take a look at those three paragraphs, because they're sort of, I'd say, the central sort of tenet here. The second thing is, if you turn to page 393, these are the major implications, or applications, we could say, of how public health was to be put in place at this time. Prevention. So if sewage treatment is the cornerstone, sewage organization might be a good way to put it, for how we're supposed to improve public health standards in a lot of these cities, 393 we see a sort of breakdown of what the three-part system is. Bottom of the page, irrigation, is the first feature. On the next page is precipitation process. And the third is a conservancy, which is to say that there's an attention on the water supply, both as sewage, as precipitation, and also as consumable water, being cornerstones for how we understand the quality of health for persons. Now, what's significant about that is that this utilitarian philosophy of trying to do the most for the most good, this post-American and French revolutionary and therefore Paris medicine-based idea of improving medical practice across the board and not just within isolated cases, is also the case that we need to be aware that improving how we remove shit and piss and waste, how we give everybody clean water, and how we deal with the rain and the precipitation that we get doesn't just improve the best of us and doesn't just improve the lowest of us who would have gotten those poor law outreach laws, but improves all of us. So it's a testament, these particular improvements that are happening, not just to how science is changing, but how political thought and democratic feelings are changing at this particular time. They're working hand in hand together. And that would have also provided the perfect sort of groundwork, again, for public health to be not just a model of efficacy for clinical practice, but a confirmation of political thought at that time as being progressive as well. And the last thing I'd have you turn to is 395, which is at the bottom of the page, the paragraph that starts, such non-technical discourse. If you take a look at that paragraph, its basic cornerstone and where much of the rest of that little section leads to is a sense that with improvements in health as a result of public health, there's also an improvement in morality. This is a central tenet or feature of what public health is born out of in the 19th century. And that can't be sort of refuted or can't be overlooked in the sense that what we're trying to do is absolutely cut down on the number of sick people, absolutely cut down on the number of deaths that are happening in the sense of contagion that may be festering or breeding or rotting in certain parts of town or with certain people. But we're also trying to improve the moral quality of the city, the town, and the populace itself. And we're trying to improve the quality of life, if you will, for persons. Not just its length, not just whether it's a healthy or unhealthy one, but whether it's a good or not good one as well. To that end, I want us to turn to Typhoid Mary. And pull up that article if you've got it. We're jumping a bit ahead here to the dawn of the 20th century, but it provides a good example, I think, for us of a lot of these features that were at the birth of public health and are present here into the beginning of the 20th century, and we're going to see it a bit at the end as well. Okay. Anybody else need one?
Yes.
Okay. So turn to the last page first. There's a bit of a biography on Typhoid Mary in the article that we read, but I thought I would just have us read this one out loud so we could hear what we're talking about. How many of you have heard of Typhoid Mary before, either as a specific person or as a euphemism, right? I mean, I mean, it's basically this idea of contagion, but it's also this idea of there being a single culprit for what could possibly be the infection of many other persons. This is on the third page of what I handed out, where we see Mary Mallon in the bed at the very forefront of this photograph. 1869, I'm just going to read it out loud so we can all hear it together. Mary is born. She might have passed out of this life as just another obscure Irish immigrant in New York, if not for unwittingly contracting typhoid fever and passing it on as a healthy carrier to dozens of people. So history remembers her infancy. I just got this from some shitty website, but I still thought it was a good summary. If perhaps a little unfairly, as the dreaded Typhoid Mary. Mallon was in her teens when she came to the United States, where she found work as a domestic servant. By all accounts a talented cook, Mallon was employed in a succession of upper-class kitchens around New York State. In the summer of 1906, she was working for a Manhattan banker, Charles Henry Warren, who had taken a vacation rental with his family on Long Island. In late August, one of the Warren daughters fell ill with typhoid fever. She was joined in quick succession by her mother, two maids, a gardener, and a second Warren daughter. The owner of the summer home feared the loss of a cash cow if word got around that the place was a breeding ground for typhoid fever. So he hired George Soper, a public health official with knowledge of the disease, to snoop around. Although Mallon had already left the family's employ, Soper soon latched onto her as the probable source. As he investigated her employment history, he discovered that similar typhoid outbreaks had accompanied Mallon wherever she went as far back as 1900. So that's sort of the short history of how she was identified as the culprit, if you will, in this outbreak. And what I provided for you were two images that are kind of famous from Typhoid Mary lore. The first is from the first article in 1909 that identified her as Typhoid Mary. Yeah, I mean, it's the extraordinary predicament of Mary Mallon, a prisoner of New York's quarantine hospital aisle. Her story, that is one of the theory of the idea of there being contagion. The birth, really, of, I think, American notions of cluster studies, if you've heard of this idea of seeing lots of different kinds of people who have an infectious disease and trying to see if they're, well, to use this model again, is a common spoke in the middle that connects various people who have a particular condition. But it's also the creation of American public health notions of quarantine as they've been put into an institutionalized governmental sort of practice. This portrait is kind of famous also for the fact that we see that she's cooking, throwing a few skulls in the frying pan, right? And, of course, I love it, too, because one, and I always love it because there's a kind of reciprocity happening between her and the frying pan, whether the frying pan is giving off the flames or whether she's spewing herself into the frying pan itself. I mean, one can't tell. But the idea being that what is supposed to be an idyllic domestic portrait is actually one that is laden with a kind of fatal sort of like implication here. The other image is the one that's on the back, the more rudimentary one. Connection to the health, typhoid carrier, any food not cooked after preparation. In this manner, the famous Typhoid Mary affected family after family. So again, taking the domestic portrait, you know, cook in the kitchen, and in some ways trying to suggest that there's a potential dangerous sort of culprit in that scenario because of what may be lurking within it, if you will. It's interesting, though, because what we're talking about here is the case of Typhoid Mary coming at a particular time in public and scientific consciousness after all of this kind of belief has been sort of like put into practice in scientific method. And yet, what's being concerned then, what becomes worrisome, is the character of this particular figure. In the case of Typhoid Mary, we know that it's because she was lower class, or she was Irish, I believe, or this idea that she might in some way have infected these rich upper class persons with the fact that she was not of the same particular standard. But it's also the fear that you can look at a domestic portrait like this, take out the skulls for a second, you know, take, or the one in here and the words, and it's the idea that what can otherwise look like a totally safe portrait might actually, because of bacterial and microbial sort of theory, have lurking within it things that are dangerous, that are not aware to the naked eye. And this becomes the thing where an individual becomes at once culpable because of who they are, or perhaps culpable simply because of the fact that given the now microscopic level we understand for contagion, anyone, anywhere that we least know might actually contain a particular illness. Look at the article, if we will, on Typhoid Mary. Let's look at a few passages. Page 269. I just want to lay out what the basic argument of this particular essay is. It's made pretty clear by the author, but I'm just going to read it out loud so we know what his particular argument is. Because while, this is why I had us look at it today, while this article is about Typhoid Mary and concerned very much with the first couple of decades in the 20th century in America, it really sets up a kind of strategy, if you will, to how to actually critique public health in general, about whether it's actually interested in the common good or actual individual persons. Is it social or is it not? Is it public or is it actually very disease-oriented? We've talked about Foucault a lot in the last couple of weeks, post-Paris medicine, in terms of the clinical gaze. What is it directed at? The question, Foucault says, changes from what is wrong with you to where does it hurt? So a kind of localization, in some ways, dehumanizes or can dehumanize the entire person. Well, public health is supposed to have its gaze spread very wide. What is the best for everyone? The case of Typhoid Mary is a good one because that gaze may not be as wide as we sometimes think it is. Sometimes it might, but it isn't always. And this article, I think, is very good at having us at least check or have pause in thinking about how public is public health. So page 269, the second complete paragraph reads, "In sum, concepts of individual resistance and susceptibility are readily related to social conditions. Molecular and cellular mechanisms of immunity, much less so. To recall the language of the old medicine, as it was once recalled by early bacteriologists, is to recover a distinct sense of the social in matters of health, a meaning unerroded by subsequent expansion of the term and unobscured by the sophistication of microbiology and immunology. That meaning will serve as a framework for what follows," which is to say that this is the framework that follows. This idea that with immunology and with microbiology, or bacteriology, that there was a decision to sort of turn away from these kinds of social weights that may have infested in for forms of notions of disease. This argument of Mendelsohn is as follows. First, the first part of this essay will argue that typhoid policy in the 20th century in New York City was humane, but not social. It did not address the social conditions that were admitted to figure along with microorganisms in the production of illness. So this argument is saying that what constitutes social in public health means being mindful of more than what is bacterial or viral or in some ways microscopic to some degree. To that end, the question, is it the conditions that we live in that cause the disease or the disease coming from outside what makes possible the conditions? Mendelsohn's argument is that it's probably and truthfully should be both. So that if we're not improving the conditions we live in, we're not really being social. But at the same time, if we're not recognizing that there could be a bacterial or viral culprit here, we're just blaming the conditions people live in, which isn't really social either because it's unfair to those particular people's responsibility in this scenario. Turning to page 270, his other three points are these. I will claim instead in the second part that the new focus on human beings as carriers of infection drew attention to them, specifically as individuals, and could not meaningfully be called social. So Typhoid Mary becomes this ideal example because on the one hand, she seems to be a part of public health because she's affecting so many people, but on the other hand, by being singled out so much, suddenly it doesn't feel quite so public or so democratic as it once did. The third part of this essay will argue more generally that the carrier state, in theory and in practice, was in fact a way of excluding rather than including attention to social factors in health. So, going back to the poor laws, if one of these functions and these utilitarian motives, as Bentham would have us believe for public health, is to have the greatest good for the greatest number of people, then why does there often remain the tendency to want to find a culprit of an individual at certain moments of public health discourse? That doesn't mean that that's not a bad philosophy. Cluster study tests actually can be quite efficacious. On the other hand, one needs to be mindful of the fact that they might have the possibility to go against the spirit of what was the founding principles of a utilitarian kind of public health. Yeah.
When we're talking about this contagion idea perfusing public health, to what extent did that infuse the public, or the average person's knowledge of disease or health or whatnot. Was that getting down from the ivory tower of academia into the public mindset?
Yeah.
I mean, clearly with Typhoid Mary, there was, you know, widespread knowledge, yeah. But before, at what point is that happening?
Yeah, it's long happening. In fact, one could say it's coming down from the ivory tower, and it's finally worked its way up to the ivory tower, which is to say the experimental method, which became so significant and then finally infiltrated, we can say, medicine, by just after Paris medicine, becomes significant because what has long been culturally, popularly sort of believed is disease potentially can infect you. The word infect did not be created by germ theory or bacteriology, you know? It's been in place. So people for centuries have been thinking that something was in me. After all, we'd seen, going back to our first couple of classes in here, that people kept thinking that disease was related to this kind of possession, if you will. So the idea that there could be a form of having something sort of in you, a disease, is not created by this particular kind of theory, but is only confirmed within science. So to that degree, what really happens is that the movement is sort of both ways about that. And as far as who's on the same page as to how much bacteriology has to do with it or not, that's just a question of dissemination taking time. But the point is to note that, as is the case with so much of medicine, we talked about this with the case of, when you ask me, like, don't doctors ever, like, learn from experience? Like, were books the only thing that were important? And the point is, like, oh, of course they did, you know? The point was, how validated was that kind of knowledge? It was a part of the arsenal that they had, but was it the most important arsenal? In the same way that the belief that disease could be an agent outside of you, did people not think that before germ theory? Of course they did, in all different forms of miasma and possession and potentially infection or dirtiness or filth, what have you. But how valid was that belief compared to other ones is sort of what changes. So what we're seeing at this time is a validation rather than a creation of the germ theory. The point was on 3 or 4 here. I can't remember. The third part of this essay will argue that the carrier stage, fourth part gives an account of how putting the carrier concept into practice pit powers against liberties, leaving laboratory definitions of danger to health unchallenged by social ones. This is just another sort of articulation of the fact that we have the question of liberties and social good being sometimes in the service of public health and sometimes at odds with it at times. Typhoid Mary is significant then for Mendelsohn and I think for so many other historians of medicine because it seems like an isolated example, but really it's just kind of a perfect articulation, if you will, of the stakes that come with public health in general. Thinking about the greatest good, thinking about the individual self. And that's actually just a nature also of trying to think about quarantine anyway. One is going to curtail the rights of an individual sometimes by protecting the greater good. But by that end, how we also offend those individual rights suggests a disservice to the greater good in some ways. I'm just going to direct you to a couple passages because I kind of want to look at a few pictures and call it a day. Look on page 271. If you could just sort of make a note to yourself, the paragraphs that start on page, compared to the incarceration and attempted disinfection of Mary Mallon, that sort of paragraph through the end of that section. But I wanted to direct you to those words that are there in that first paragraph. Incarceration, disinfection, and surveillance. So big words there. These are three strategies, one could say, and cornerstones of public health, but they all speak to efficacious ways with which to provide the greatest good for the greatest number of people, but all three things that absolutely can cut at the individual rights of persons and therefore threaten how much public health is seen as a democratizer or an offense to democracy. Incarceration, disinfection, and surveillance. Look on page 274. This here is the paragraph that starts the carrier state. The carrier state was then both a powerful concept and a limited one. From the bacteriological point of view, the identification of a carrier could explain the origin of an outbreak. From the epidemiological point of view, however, proof of the carrier's danger to others was usually lacking. Some even disputed the evidence that Typhoid Mary had caused the disease outbreaks from which she was traced. More generally lacking were allowances for Y and Z, so to speak, for those other variables, including social ones, that could determine why, given a constant source of carried infection, an epidemic began and ended when it did, or why one exposed individual fell ill and another did not. habitual appeal for the role of carriers in spreading disease, instead of acknowledgement of epidemiological unknowns, threatened to become a, and this is sort of the big term in this article, doctrine of carriers. This is sort of one of the main points here, is this question of public health looking at, we said, population, a large number of persons, or public health being a focus on the individual. Now, when public health first comes into birth in the 19th century, it is seen as a movement towards population medicine, a looking away from individuals. But as we see in many cases that focus on the notion of how to curtail particular diseases, especially given the ability to isolate a particular kind of virus or bacteria, what happens is that we begin to return to a focus on individuals. And this return to individuals is what Mendelssohn calls the doctrine of carriers. This idea that in now turning towards populations, what we need to do in order to protect the population is turn and look for individuals. Individuals therefore becoming carriers, or one could go so far as to say culprits. This does not disavow or take away the efficacy of that particular strategy. It just shows a real transition and a shift culturally and loyalty-wise towards what, how do we define public health? Public health is shifting and changing in how it's being done, but my point is it's shifting and changing how it's being defined. How do we define that word public changes, and how do we define that word health changes in these moments? Typhoid Mary is such a good example because she becomes an epidemiological culprit. But that's because she's also a sociological culprit, too, for a kind of class of a particular time. She is somebody who absolutely becomes the linchpin for how to identify how a whole cluster of people could be sick because of how she connects them. But on the other hand, she also becomes the scapegoat, if you will, to some degree. And overemphasizing the carrier model, the doctrine of carriers, Mendelssohn argues, there is often the attempt to not look at what could be other contributing factors, which is to say that perhaps Typhoid Mary did not give the disease to these people, but rather there was some other source of water supply or experience or some other person that may have been responsible. Or it could be that maybe she was partly responsible. But an over-attempt to try to isolate and find the single individual sometimes leads to an oversimplification of what public health is. I mention that not because we need to banter back and forth about what the right solution was. It's just to show that inherent in public health, from its foundings, through its transitions, and even today, is a tension between trying to find the most complex approximation, explanation for why an epidemic happens, or trying to find the most absolute, concentrated, singular reason for why an epidemic happens. And public health, to be fair, has to be mindful of both. And Mendelssohn's point is that there are times historically and there are times contemporarily where it's hard to do both at the same time. Yeah?
Actually, it seems like most of the law really hasn't changed officially. In 1978, my wife was working on, hired to work on a grant investigating typhoid carriers in Philadelphia. The thing is, about 2% of typhoid infections will develop asymptomatic carriers, usually in the biliary tract.
Mm-hmm.
And what the law says in Philadelphia is you have a cholecystectomy if you. If you're a carrier. They check everybody after they're cleared. Yet, and if you're still a carrier, you get a cholecystectomy. If you don't, you can refuse if you want, but actually you it's a criminal offense to work as a food handler at that point.
Hmm.
And she actually found one working at the vet and one working at Spectrum at that time.
Do you know how, like, and I don't know.
There are about 30 carriers in the city at that time.
I was going to ask, what's the likelihood of being an asymptomatic carrier? Or
about 30 in the city, most of whom were recent immigrants.
Okay. Huh. Yeah. It's interesting, though, even that question of the asymptomatic speaks back to this idea then about the fact of how recognizable, how noticeable is the disease, so to speak. So symptomology is one aspect, but and so is also the fact of microbiology, this idea of not being able to see actual manifestations of the illness or not being able to see the illness itself because of the fact that it could be microbial or bacterial to some degree. That's where sort of cultural preconceptions sometimes step in to try to supplant for what is invisible, so to speak.
The other problem was also that they were infectious, they were forbidden to work in food handling, but it wasn't considered a disability and they had no other skills.
Oh, right.
So it was a lose-lose situation for that.
Right. Well, this is the same situation, speaking of which, we can segue for a second, towards people who are seropositive who had AIDS, too, which is to say for quite a long time, you could be considered contagious and therefore discharged, but at the same time, you didn't qualify under the American with Civil Disabilities Act. It's different now. Now, AIDS persons with seropositive qualify, in large part, given the chronicity of AIDS at this particular time, it's easier to categorize it as a disability because of its enduring sort of presence rather than its immediate fatal consequences. But I wanted to throw it as an example, if people knew who patient zero was. If you're Canadian, you probably do.
Yeah.
It's sort of that significant of a national figure. Patient zero, or as his real name, Gaétan Dugas was a French-Canadian flight attendant who lived, traveled all around North America for the most part in the 70s and 80s, homosexual man, living in the age of sexual sort of liberation, so to speak, very promiscuous sort of lifestyle, not unlike quite a few gay men at that time. But he was one of the first people to contract HIV in the very early 1980s. Now, what the CDC did when it was first called in, when these first cases of gay men dying of AIDS in New York and San Francisco in particular, was that their response was to try to do one of these particular kinds of doctrine of carriers cluster study, it's called. So,
cluster study,
I've used that word a couple times today, was to try to identify who can we find as a common person, a common factor between all of these disparate people. Are they related? Have they had a similar friend? Or in the case of HIV and AIDS, have they had a common sexual partner? Now, it just so happens that in these cases of HIV that first came up largely in New York, but also in San Francisco and to a lesser degree in places like Chicago and Los Angeles, the one person had some sexual connection to persons in each of these cities, and in some cases several people in these cities, was Gaétan Dugas. And according to the CDC cluster studies that were happening at this particular time, he was identified as patient zero. And the term is a sort of a, what you call it, anonymous pseudonymous sort of like identification that the cult, the originator, if you will, of this particular case. Now, of course, we know that it's very likely that he's somebody who, if not infected other people, just was certainly in sexual contact with other people who could have been infected. The hard part about it is that while this individual was both vilified and to some degree also identified as perhaps the source of this condition, we also could simply say, well, he was also a person who was a flight attendant, so he's just traveling around to all these cities. It's at once the thing that could be accountable for the spread of the disease, was thought, but it also could have been the circumstantial thing that made him liable for being labeled as the patient zero at this time. The problem is not the fact that there was a patient zero identified. The problem in finding a correlate here to this article by Mendelsohn is that how does it provide yet another example or manifestation of the fact of this doctrine of carriers that could be in place? It's a doctrine that does not have to be thrown out with the baby in the bathwater, but it is one that needs to make us mindful of how we're trying as public health officials to find a single individual carrier, or whether we're trying to be mindful of what could be the more complex sort of forms of dissemination and contagion, if you will, at a particular time. Yeah.
You already dealt with this, sorry. How did they find this? Like, what kind of sleuthing would they have done to find out?
How'd they find him?
Yeah.
Well, because he volunteered. They would go to bathhouses and they would go around the cities, and people who had tested positive, actually had the symptoms, the T cell count, or had the pneumonia or the Kaposi sarcoma lesions, whatever, that were indicative of the disease at that time, and they asked them if they'd be willing to submit to interviews. The thing about him was that he was probably one of the most compliant people to these CDC studies that were happening at that time. He was very forthcoming about, well, as a matter of fact, I have a black book. I can tell you all the people I slept with if you want to know. He's very braggy and stuff like that, you know? And to that end, he becomes a figure that is, on the one hand, according to some narratives, as seen as the villain of the AIDS narrative in its early years. On the other hand, according to some person, he's seen as one of the great compatriots of the people who were trying to curtail the disease. The hard part is the fact, and this is sort of one of these points, is that if Typhoid Mary is vilified because of the fact of what she did, or because she was poor, or because she was uneducated and Irish, or because just because she was sick, or because she happened to be somebody, by circumstance, who spread this contagious disease, there's a correlate at the end of the century, beginning to end of the century, of somebody who was perhaps vilified or isolated as the culprit because of the fact that maybe he did infect these people. We don't know. We'll never know, right? Or was it because of the fact that he was homosexual? Was it because of the fact that he was promiscuous and did not deny it? Was it because of the fact that, according to most accounts, even when he found out he was sick, he still continued to have a lot of sex, but that's also because no one knew for 100% certain how it was spread? And what happens then is not so much whether we perform a cluster study, not so much whether we identify absolutely whether we think this person did it, but how we as historians also have a responsibility to think about how do we place that person in the narrative of the public health history or the history of this particular epidemic. And my point of bringing up patient zero is not to suggest that it is a special example or to assess it just like Typhoid Mary, but that again, that there is, from its inception in public health and from its development and at different moments, and I think there will be in the future, always pitfalls. I don't think a necessity or always an absolute tendency to want to vilify or valorize, you know, stigmatize or romanticize certain persons with disease, but there's always the tendency and the possibility for it. It's just inherent in the possibility and the philosophy of wanting to do epidemiologically the greatest good for the greatest number of people. And in that then, if you're going to have the greatest good, there's always the possibility of thinking about, well, who comes out as the bad guy. even in the face of bacteriology and microbiology and different forms of disease theory like that, there's still going to be a possibility for value judgment to be weighed in there. Any other thoughts? Yeah.
It just kind of reminds me of, like, in social work, we talk about othering and the dangers of othering. I don't know. It just got me thinking.
Well, that's, like, it's a perfect sort of medical example of it. In the case of AIDS, you know, we tended to other that disease in when it first came out, and what's categorized as the 4 or 5 H's. There were 4 or 5 groups of persons that were identified as, these are people that get AIDS. And they all start with the letter H. You want to start taking guesses who they were?
Patients, homosexuals, heroin addicts, and
hemophiliacs. Patients, homosexuals, heroin addicts, hemophiliacs, and...
Heroin
users?
We
said patients. Hookers. Sex workers. So, but again, this is an attempt to... We're actually statistically some of the highest risk groups to get the disease in the early years. But it just so happened that, unfortunately, for people who... had HIV and AIDS in the years to be populations that were highly stigmatized, whether because of class or race or sexuality or gender or profession or drug use or addiction. Here we go. So we're going to look at some of our posters before we close.
While you're reading them out,
when it was
in the reading, it was talking. I never understood smelliness
is
next to godliness.
Uh-huh.
That
is a euphemism?
No.
Yeah,
I never
really liked it. Well, I actually, well, be honest with you, I don't know its etymology, like where it comes from either.
But sort of when you were doing the readings and you talked about the moral good of cities and being clean, I don't know.
I'd be surprised if cleanliness comes next to godliness is absolutely coming from this. It just starts because it's such a long-standing cultural belief anyway. People are going to, you know, main sana and corpore sano, Latin motto, a sound mind and a sound body. This idea that you're going to have a kind of like moral quality of goodness that's reflected in how you live your life. So, and that goes back to the damn Romans and ancient Greeks,
well,
you know.
If you go back to Deuteronomy, most of the law of Deuteronomy is hygiene. It's not really medicine. Yes.
Yeah, but that does also mean that when public health comes about, it becomes a kind of like ideal manifestation of long-standing sort of cultural predispositions like that. Yeah?
I'm just going to see if there's another photo.
There's another one?
Another.
Oh, we have an extra?
Yeah.
Okay,
good.
No, we need one. I got an extra, so what? Thanks for telling me. Let's look at a couple of these. And this is just for fun here, mostly for us to see again how these are. And by the way, if you're doing a history of medicine, one of the most fun forms to do history of medicine, one of the most sort of prolific since about the 1970s is public health posters. Mm-hmm. It is like one of like the cornerstone sort of like texts that people love to use. And the reason they like to use it is a couple. I'll tell you right now, let's write these down. One, they're fun. Two, the fact that they're highly disseminated. So for people who are, the public health poster dates to about the beginning of the 1900s. There are some versions of them before, but the real dissemination and regular dissemination of public health posters happens in many ways to war efforts that are happening just after the Crimean, the First World War, and print culture making that possible. So they're highly disseminated. If we've made a turn towards social medicine in our horse historiography, remember how we talked about this in the semester? The public health posters are great for that because they're not in specialized, privileged spaces, but they're all over the damn place. Secondly, they have an absolute strategy, a theory, and a philosophy, so you can close read them, analyze them, and scrutinize them, so they become a perfect sort of tool to try to find the nuance in what others seems like a rather transparent sort of document. Thirdly, they reveal medical knowledge as it's understood, not just in the professional sense, but as it's translated into the popular sense. And fourthly, how they do that in the best possible way is they have such a visual component to them that they speak to both the literate and the illiterate. The long-term and the short-term sort of effect. Or as I like to put it, public health posters are great because they lend great credence to the way that one is supposed to look at them for a long time. And really be informed and affected by them. Because you can go to your clinic and see the same poster over and over again. Or you're stuck in the waiting room and the half hour there, you're just looking at the same poster and over again. How many of us didn't have this in high school health class where they had some of those posters on the wall? By the end of the semester, you could know that poster backwards and forward, right? I knew one that was one for his anti-smoking one.
Yeah.
It had Robin Givens on it. Remember Robin Givens from the head of the class who was married to Mike Tyson? This is before she got famous. I don't know. So she had to do a public health poster for work. So the picture of her, like this, jeans, purse, And she had a cigarette, and at the top it said the Dragon Lady, but Dragon was D-R-A-G-G-I-N, like high apostrophe or whatever, you know? And then it just pointed out, like, things that were bad about her because she smoked or whatever. But let me tell you, that poster was in the classroom, and health was boring in high school, so I must have stared at Dragon Lady like 1,000 times that semester, right? But public health posters lend themselves to the lingering, but they also lend themselves to the scammed. Too, which is to say the public health posters, like most posters, like movie posters, like music posters, like billboards, are there because they're supposed to catch your eye. So if you ever want to know what's persuasive about a public health poster, I give a piece of advice. One, stare at it for about 10 minutes and look at every detail. But also at some point make yourself do this. You know, put the poster up. Hold it for me. Thank you. And then give yourself one of these. Does it look like that? And what do you remember when you looked at it? That's also a public health poster. So they reward both the lingering and the quick sort of observation. That's part of why it's just why they're such an important sort of tool of the history of medicine. They're democratic, they're detailed, they have a message, they have a philosophy, they're populist and they're also professional. They reward close scrutiny and they reward scant scrutiny at the same time. So let's look at a few. Let's start at the top on page one. Two side by side here. The one on the top left, and these date from the First World War, says, "Steady, buddy, there's a comeback." So just tell me what stands out to you all there. Well, what's the message?
There are repercussions if you go with her.
Totally. And those probably being?
Disease,
yeah. Disease, discharge. Disservice to your country, if you will, by having the infection. I mean, the pun in here is supposed to be that normally if you hit on a girl, you know, or say something, hey, to it, see nice gams, or whatever the hell they say at that time, right? Trying to be period here. The idea is she might come with a comeback, like, take a hike, Buster, this is where you get off, or something like that, right? But the idea is there might also be an epidemiological comeback to that kind of come on. Could be. She's a good time girl, I guess we'd say, but I don't know whether she does this for a living or not, right? So, but there is a sense that, but certainly her pose and sort of her look over her shoulder and she's smiling, one gets the sense that what she's saying and the point is supposed to be is that she's not actually going to give him a comeback. Like, no way. But she's actually going to give him a comeback of a different sort for this particular portrait. And of course, we can see that the man is a serviceman. You know, you can see in his uniform there. So this is a poster that's really directed towards a specific audience as well. It comes from the same series of posters that came out of the Social Hygiene Division of the American Army Service in this particular decade. So there was a specific branch of the medical service of the Army that was concerned with social hygiene, the two words being significant. The one on the right, then, is from that same series. It says, "Go back to them physically fit and morally clean."
Oh my goodness.
And the portrait.
Nobody's going after her.
Well, no, she doesn't have a comeback. Said pass the frosting or whatever she's doing, right? But the portrait there is, of course, now idealizing what you're fighting for, what you're defending to that degree. To that end, it's not highlighting what to be warned about, to be tempted about, but what not to forget. And to that end, what's provided, the portrait looks like it's off of, I don't know, Pillsbury. Flower box or a rock, what is it?
Rock
something like that. Then, yeah, so, I mean, it's so saccharine I'm getting a toothache looking at it, but it's very sweet, right? But the idea is supposed to be that there's a kind of like lesson to be learned at the level of public health and social hygiene that has an absolute moral sort of quality there, a barometer, even if you will, in the portrait. I love the one on the bottom right too, just because it sort of gestures a bit back towards the phrenology that we talked about last week that's put in the place here. Is your mind diseased here? And of course, you know, the blindfold and salacious thoughts that are inside. I want to turn the page, though, to one of my absolute favorite public health posters of all time.
Oh,
it's on the left. It's actually from, I think, about 1943, if you want to know the exact date. I've caught it so many times. That, and it says, "She may look clean, but..." And then underneath of it is, "Pickups, good time girls, prostitutes, spread syphilis and gonorrhea. You can't beat the axis if you get BB." Is the message that we have here. So, yes.
I was gonna say. So, this is pretty much like verbatim to an ad, except it's somewhat reversed. that's in the immunization office at Penn right now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like this girl kind of looking over her shoulder, like hug, like kind of embracing this guy, and it's like, you may know him so well.
Oh,
yeah.
this message is, I don't even think this poster had been it, that message of, you may think you know what you're getting. I mean, that, and that's the message of the one before that we saw. You know, steady buddy, there's a comeback. It's the same, you know, she may look one thing, but she's actually another. What's that?
I said, I'm just thinking they're not,
Oh, no, it's like, that the message persists. It's yeah. This idea that what we think of as a culturally specific, temporally specific sort of concern about how we talk about public health and how we talk about disease and someone being valid or not is an enduring problem. It's absolutely enduring. Yeah.
Something that's interesting, and I'm sure we'll see as we go chronologically down the time, but I took a class where we actually just looked at venereal disease posters, and the way they frame it changes over time, and it's very interesting because in the start, it's very the woman is the source of the disease, she has bad character, don't even touch her, don't even come near her.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll see then the original posters, like the woman who carries the venereal disease, and it's very preventative, don't even do it. And then the military comes to realize, well, we can't stop that. Then it becomes about, okay, do it, but use prophylactics. And so it's very interesting how, and now in modern society, it's the man who's like the person with the bad character, and he's going to give it to you. But it's interesting how it shifts from the woman being the culprit to kind of like, we'll do it, but, you know, like, we'll turn a blind eye, just make sure you don't get infected.
Right.
And now, like, in contemporary society, it's the man who's the bad person, right?
Well, several of these absolutely pit the woman as the culprit, and there's an overattempt, and this does not date from this era. It actually dates from about 50 years prior to syphilis portraiture happening at the end of the 19th century that tended to portray, for example, syphilis was always personified as the beautiful woman. And a beautiful woman that might be like, you know, hair flowy or what have you, and she's looking in a mirror, but the reflection in the mirror is like a skeleton, you know what I mean? So it's the temptation. Now, that's not my theory, though, is that it's not an attempt to want to just vilify women. Women stink, you know, they're the syphilis, you know? It shows less who we're vilifying than who we're trying to protect. You know, since we're living in a heterosexual climate with these particular posters, what it says less to me is that we're trying to say women are bad than it says men are worth protecting. And that's why so many of these posters come from the war effort in the wartime, because the point of these is not to try to say that you're going to gain any ground by making women look like shit or disease carriers. It's because you're going to save ground if you keep your men healthy. So that attempt to want to vilify women has a kind of like second sort of like turn to it. But this is a classic example of that total point, and that's even this girl who's like total Donna Reed girl next door, right? She may look clean, but, you know, so, and I love the butt also, too.
That was the last modeling gig she probably had.
Probably, right? She was never going to get work again. I'm just not going to buy you as the girl next door. I don't know why, you know, that sort of reason. But, you know, pickups, good time girls, prostitutes. I mean, the point is that there's references to all these different kinds of professions that don't match up to the portrait that we see of her. And yet, spread syphilis and gonorrhea. If we did the walk-by test on this one, I mean, I think it would be, I'd walk by and be like, did I just see syphilis and gonorrhea under Donna Reed's picture? That would be like the pause for a second.
So what would this be attempted to get at? Okay, so you can't trust anybody, therefore...
You can't trust any. Well, the point.
Oh, so yeah, telling the guy, so what's he supposed to ask?
Well, I would think one message would be keep it in your pants.
Don't
yeah.
Which isn't going to work.
But the prophylaxis message is a good one because it comes up, and actually, it's not that even that we just shift from abstinence to prophylaxis, it's that we shift the idea of sending both messages at the same time. Mm-hmm. Which is if you actually look at safe sex discourse and safer sex discourse in the past 30 years, half of it's the same thing. Abstinence, prophylaxis, safe sex. Don't have sex, you know? And that really changes from political climate to political climate, administration to administration. This was definitely about one of those, like, you can't tell a damn thing from the outside, so absolutely, probably, absolutely is the best sort of precaution. Yeah?
Did you mention what the axis was?
The axis from the Second World War, so Germany, Italy,
Japan.
Japan, thank you, yeah. So, or as we'll see in another one, Hirohito, Hitler, Mussolini, you know, so it's this idea. One of them has my favorite rhyme, too, which is, you can't beat the axis without prophylaxis. They have that rhyme in it. My favorite thing about this portrait, though, too, is that as innocent as the woman looks, the men that are beside her, you can see, are military men for the most part. A sailor, definitely an army man, maybe a civilian, but maybe also somebody from a different branch who's an officer. But how they are positively dwarfed by the size of this woman, as innocent as she appears, is almost a kind of monstrosity, incredible giant woman, so to speak. So the kind of looming presence, even of this girl next door, is sort of invoked when it's coupled with syphilis and the way it works.
Me and I don't have to close it off.
That's okay. Just figure it out. But the next page is my favorite, by the way.
Sorry.
Booby trap.
Oh, yeah. Booby trap. That's a classic.
I love booby trap. it's just straightforward, you know, booby trap. Now, this is the one that might actually say that you can judge a book by its cover here, you know. But it's actually playing up in wartime terminology with what is... And the point of these so often is supposed to be that there is absolutely a front line to a war. And it might be off in France, mm-hmm. and it might be someplace where espionage is happening, but it might be at the corner bar, either when you're off to off service or before you even leave. To that end, a booby trap could be someplace as simple as, you know, where you're, you know, on leave for a certain period of time, or where you're on RR at a particular moment. To that degree, it also suggests the implied messages. If you're a soldier, you're always a soldier. You're always on the clock. And to that degree, your loyalty to your service and your country and your family, keep them fit and morally clean, Betty Crocker at home, is you're always duty-bound to them. So don't take a break from that. In fact, this one here about where it says almost VD is to suggest it's a portrait of a soldier who wanted to enlist, but could not enlist because of the fact that he had found out that he had positive for VD. So it even suggests that the potential future serviceman in some way owes a duty to that particular cause, even before he actually steps on the front lines, what have you.
Were recruits required to have VD testing?
They were by the Second World War, and I'm trying to think whether they were by the First. It might have been quite as ubiquitous simply because testing wasn't as cost efficient yet, so it might have required suspicion or symptom before it might have, but by Second World War it's absolutely imperative, such that by the time you're reaching about the 30s, it's also required to get a marriage license to have a VD test as well, too. So what changes is then not the possibility for those tests, but what's cost-effective, so to speak, and once it's cost-effective, it's standardized.
Well, yeah. But also, I think in the 20s and 30s, the antibodies came on the market, and then became treatable. And I guess the question is, why would you test for an untreatable disease? And that was the argument for never testing individuals for HIV for a marriage license.
Right.
Was that there's nothing you can do about it.
And yet, why continue to test even when it can be treatable is to suggest that it can still be an impediment towards the efficacy or of the war service in particular, even the marriage bed itself. And to that degree, despite the creation of antibiotics that can eradicate some of the diseases in individuals, these kinds of portraits still exist. Just look at a couple for fun. I like the one on worst of the three. Mm-hmm. It's Hirohito, Hitler, and then this is a classic portrait of here VD, but it looks very much like a classic syphilitic portrait. You will notice that if you go to a portrait gallery, go to a Philadelphia Museum of Art or something, there's quite often a portrait in one of those that has a personification of syphilis or some other venereal disease, and it looks almost kind of exactly like that. The next page is a couple more about sex exposure without, I think it's prophylaxis or condoms, is a help to the axis. Prophylaxis presents venereal disease, and then there's the toasted one, Axis agents, toasted Hitler and Hirohito. The point of this is to say, you know, think about the images we saw of Typhoid Mary, an example of her. Look at these portraits that actually come from a few decades later. Consider the figure of patient zero in the era of AIDS, and bear that in mind with the lessons and the history that we've learned about where public health came out of. My point is not to try to find a culprit in how public health is done, or to try to find a flaw in the fact of what it's trying to do, but to show that there is an almost inevitable kind of difficulty and need for public health ever since the groundwork was laid for its very foundations of the 19th century, an enduring possibility. If there is a great change in the 19th century in which public health can be born as a new kind of significant discipline, there is going to remain a continuity with which the stakes in which public health can both affect and also perhaps taint in its own way the social well-being of people who are suspect to its services. I'm going to end there, and thanks so much, everybody. Next week, we are doing
eugenics.
Great. Thanks, everybody.
No, that's the last one.
That's the last one.
So instead, we're doing...
Remember.
Oh, we're doing the teaching hospital and the Rice Laboratory. Yep.
Or if you're
Yeah.
But that makes me think also that there's a possibility that somewhere some
Right, it's a disease of promiscuity. And if you then have a committed relationship, that is
If it looks like you even tried, they don't care.
I want to try to get a new photo of Kirby.
I don't.
cold. They're like, I should set the date.
Oh, did I not turn this off yet?
Friday. I put on Friday.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, gosh, you're
Friday.